Hi everyone, Lutfi and Nick from PRT Weekly here. Today we are joined by the Honorable Mr. Tom Mulcair. Mr. Mulcair is the former leader of the federal NDP and the former leader of the federal opposition under the Harper government. Mr. Mulcair is currently the Member of Parliament for the District of Outremont in Quebec and the former Minister of Sustainable Development, Environment and Parks of Quebec. Mr. Mulcair, thank you for joining us here.
Well, it's good to be here with you, Lutfi, and hi to you too, Nick.
So, Mr. Mulcair, you started your career as a lawyer, but have now been involved in the public service and politics for decades. So what was it that made you want to become a public servant? And did you ever imagine that you would be involved in politics to the extent that you have been?
Well, I was inspired from a young age by a tremendous figure in my life who was actually a priest in our high school who really showed us very early on that there's a lot that we can do to make things better in our society and that there were a lot of people who needed help. And that was when I was 13, 14 years old, and I always wanted to get into government. I went to law school mostly as a way of making sure that I could contribute. And when I finished law school, I went and worked in the Quebec government in Quebec City, at the Justice Department in the legislation branch, where you get all these great ideas that are coming in, and you get to make them concrete and put them into a form where they can actually change people's lives positively. So that's always been inspiring for me. I've had great influences in my life. My mom and dad were very much involved in public service as well. I come from a family of 10 children, and we were taught very young to assume our responsibilities. And that's the type of thing that I've been able to do.
And did you imagine, even at that young age, that you might ever want to be involved in politics?
Oh, for sure. Because I saw that as the best way of making change. But of course, we can bring positive change by being involved in community groups. I've just taken on the chairmanship of the board of directors of the France-Quebec Earth Day organization, which is a large, well-structured group. And when I leave politics this coming summer, I'll be teaching at the university. And that's also a very strong, powerful force for change in our society. So I'm going to be continuing to try to bring positive change. I'll just be doing it in a different place from now on.
Absolutely.
So you have tremendous experience in Canadian government, both as an elected official and as an appointed public servant. What was it like to transition from appointed public servant to running for public office?
I think that people of varied backgrounds can all contribute a great deal. If you go back 50 or so years and you look at the composition of most provincial parliaments across Canada, and indeed at the House of Commons, you'll notice that the majority of members of parliament were lawyers. Well, if you look today, you've got a wonderful variety of experiences and backgrounds. You've got people who were teachers. You've got people who have worked in industry. You've got people who have owned businesses. You've got people who are just well-connected and respected in their local community and have decided that they want to contribute by running for and getting elected. So, you know, it's a varied background today. I think that that's, frankly, the best way to have a parliament that represents the society that it's looking to serve and to make laws for. And I am, across Canada, always gobsmacked by the quality of people that I meet. And no matter what their background or experience or training or education, I'm always encouraging people to give it a shot, you know, so you can start at a different level. You know, a lot of people will start, for example, in municipal politics and learn what it's like to run in a campaign and learn what it's like to be part of a decision-making process. And then they can move on and apply that experience, maybe provincially or federally. I think that's a really great way to get good people involved in politics.
So based on your experience, what are the biggest differences between being an appointed public servant and an elected official?
Well, I hope to be able to tell you this story and you to be able to understand in the podcast that I have a big smile on my face as I'm telling it. But at one point in my career, I was occupying a rather high-level position. I was the president of a large regulatory agency in Quebec. And I remember sitting down with our minister and trying to convince him to follow, because he was the type of person you were better off to make a very short note. So we would always try to get things under a page. It was a complex issue involving the recognition and regulation of midwives in the province of Quebec. So it was a complex dossier, and I remember being, finding it a difficult process. And he was a minister, and he was an elected official, and he was our minister, and of course we owed him a lot of deference for that. But I remember at the end of that meeting, turning to the person who was the vice president of our regulatory agency, saying, "You know what? I want his job, because." If no matter how well you do your job in the senior public service, the people who actually do make the decisions invariably are going to be somebody at the ministerial level. So I guess it prepares you well to understand how governments work and how tough it is in the tough choices that you have to make. And it's quite rigorous. It's very demanding. And maybe that's great preparation for politics as well.
Right. And so shifting a little bit more now toward some kind of current affairs we'd like to have your perspective on. There's been a surge of populism in many Western liberal countries, as characterized perhaps most notably by Donald Trump's campaign and time in office so far. As a man who's seen it all in Canadian politics, do you think that a similar story could ever unfold in Canada? And is it already here?
Well, it is already here, depending on the place and the time. I mean, it's here because in some provinces there will be a more populist approach on some issues. I don't think we've ever experienced anything like Donald Trump here or, frankly, anywhere else, certainly in recent times. And interestingly enough, some of Mr. Trump's ideas, although I find it horrible that he attacks people based on their religion or their ethnic origin, some part of his critique of international trade agreements with regard to its effect on ordinary workers, some part of that critique has been shared for many years. By the NDP. We've always been very concerned that it was a bit of a race to the bottom with some of these agreements, and we were a bit worried when you looked at the possible impact on the environment, what was actually happening with these deals. So, you know, there's a way to look at populism. It depends on whose side you're on and which point of view you have on any given day and on any given subject. But I don't think you can summarize it just that way. But I do think that we are in a new era when the classic news media in the States, you had three major networks that basically dominated the news and decided what was news. And, you know, Mr. Trump's decided to tear that up, sometimes with interesting and fascinating consequences, sometimes with terrifying and frankly horrible consequences. So I don't see us getting there in Canada. Our history is different. Our institutions are different. For example, I mean, it's an obvious one, but the Americans always talk about the importance of the separation of powers between the judiciary, the court system, in other words, the legislators, the people who are elected to both houses of Congress, and finally the executive, which is the president and his cabinet or her cabinet, one would hope one day. Well, in Canada, our cabinet sits in the front row in Parliament. They're right there. So we don't have that real separation of the executive and the legislative. So our systems of government are quite different. Our history is different. We have a parliamentary democracy. We still got the Queen on our $20 bill. So it is quite different from the U.S. System. And I don't see the possibility of someone quite of that stripe. But who knows? I don't think anybody would have. I don't know too many people who predicted before November of 2016 that Mr. Trump was going to win, although I know a lot of people now who claim that they did.
Right, yeah.
I have a question about the electoral reform. Given that the Liberal government ran on a platform to reform our electoral system, but now Trudeau has given up on this promise, what is the future of electoral reform in Canada? Do we still have the momentum and the motivation to pursue electoral reform in the next foreseeable future?
Well, that's also a question of leadership, isn't it? I mean, if you have someone who runs on a promise to make sure that 2015 was going to be Canada's last election with our unfair first-past-the-post system, you'd actually hope that that person would respect that promise and put everything in place to make that promise be realized. In the case of Mr. Trudeau, it was one of the most cynical operations I've ever seen in Canadian political history. He got elected on a promise of proportional representation, or at least democratic reform. And lo and behold, once he got elected, he said, well, you know what? We needed democratic reform to get rid of Stephen Harper's Conservatives, but since I'm popular, we don't need it anymore. And talk about summarizing everything by bringing it to yourself. It wasn't about Mr. Trudeau. It was about Canadian voters. It was about our democracy. It was about our society. And he told people what they wanted to hear on this issue and it helped him get elected. And then he simply tore up that promise. Our system is very unfair. Mr. Trudeau is governing with a very large majority with barely 39% of the vote. Well, that's not fair in and of itself. And that's why he promised people who think about these things to fix it. Is it complex? Absolutely. It's very complex. Can we come up with a system that would have provided a better result without, you know, tearing down all of the institutions that have served us so well for so many years? Of course we could have done that. But if your intention is to say that nothing's working, well, then you won't do anything and you'll try to just convince yourself that nothing needed to be done. There's this great expression here in Quebec. We say that sometimes when you've decided you're going to shoot your dog, you tell the neighbors it had rabies. Well, Mr. Trudeau's now trying to say that proportional representation or any other democratic reform to make our system more democratic is fraught with problems. The biggest problem that he found was for the Liberal Party. He's not going to make any change that he thinks is not in his best interest. And I'll contrast that with the NDP's position. Our position would be of a distinct help to the Green Party, which is underrepresented by compared to the number of votes they've got. Well, even though it would help an adversary, in this case the Green Party, we think that the right result is to give the Green Party more voices in Parliament, and that's why we continue to believe in the principle of proportional representation.
Right. And switching gears a little bit, the next thing I'd like to ask you about is the 50+1 stance on referendum decisions. So I agree that in a democracy, you know, the winners win. And in the case of elections, say for prime minister, even if a person's, you know, worst case scenario nightmare candidate is elected, that person can only be in office for so long. In the case of a referendum for national independence, however, the positive outcome of that referendum is permanent for all intents and purposes, assuming that negotiations are completed and succession actually occurs. Do you think that the gravity of the decision constitutes grounds for more rigorous standards for a yes vote, especially considering that the referendum's held with such a narrow margin are particularly susceptible to manipulation when the public is narrowly divided, as there was evidence of in some ridings in the 1995 Quebec referendum, particularly with the advent of modern concerns around digital voter manipulation, some of the things that have happened in the States, or at least that allegedly happened in the States. How do you justify maintaining such a narrow margin for deciding referendums?
Well, that's a great question, and I think that part of your question provides the answer. When you go back to the 1995 referendum and you realize what happened, and you talk about some ridings where a lot of votes were rejected, in my riding, which is called Chomedy, because I was a provincial member at the time, Chomedy is written Chomedey, it's in Laval, Quebec, I had over 5,000 votes that were declared invalid. In some ballot boxes, Nick, more than 50% of the votes were declared invalid. If you look after that, if you look at the Supreme Court reference decision, which came out in August 1998, somewhere around paragraph 87 from memory, you'll find a reference to what the Supreme Court refers to as qualitative clarity. So it's not enough to just say the quantity, 50% plus one, is enough to win, but you have to look at all aspects of it. And there's a very recent example in the Commonwealth, it's in England, it's in Great Britain with the Brexit vote. Now, there's been really disturbing information come out that there was cheating by the Leave side in the Brexit vote, cheating on the amount of money being spent. That's what the Supreme Court is talking about when it talks about the quality of the clarity. So we in the NDP have said, for example, that there has to be agreement on what the question is. It has to be clear. Actually, the British got that right in a recent referendum when the Scottish people were asked to decide whether or not they felt like leaving Great Britain. Just to complete the thought, there is a bit of an irony there, because one of the Great Britain's overarching arguments against Scotland leaving is they risked losing their membership in the European Union. Now, Northern Ireland and Scotland are being dragged kicking and screaming into this madcap adventure, which is Brexit. And I think that it shows just how right you are when you realize, you know, how tight these races can be and how important the consequences are. But let me give you another argument the other way, Nick. You say, you know, well, maybe it should be more than 50% plus one. If you start with the proposition that it's, what, 55, maybe 60, who knows? If you say that to people and you say nothing will happen if you vote 55 or 60%, then you're almost inviting people, as we've seen recently in Spain, when the government started misbehaving with regard to the secession referendum in Catalonia, people there started saying, well, the vote in favor of separation of Catalonia from Spain went way up because the government had been misbehaving and trying to frustrate democracy. I know that Mr. Trudeau has never been able to answer the simple question, well, then if it's not 50% plus one, what is it? What did it take for Newfoundland Labrador to join Confederation? Well, it was actually 50% plus one on the button. So what sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. This is a very important debate. The good news is I live here in Quebec, and I can tell you that separation is not on a lot of people's minds. What people are worried about today, mostly young families, if you ask them, making sure that they can pay for their mortgage, that they have a house to live in, that their kids are getting good education, that there's a hospital service there for them or their family if they need it. Those are the real cares that people have. And right now, it's a bit theoretical to be talking about a referendum. But if it ever does happen, the Supreme Court of Canada, in a unanimous decision in August 1998, did a tremendous job of setting down the rules, including the notion of a qualitative clarity in the process, in addition to the quantitative clarity, which, of course, is 50% plus one.
Mm-hmm.
So now, on a more personal note, what keeps Tom Mulcair up at night?
Well, you know, the good news is I'm pretty happy with what I've been able to accomplish in my career. I've tried to, you know, to work on big issues like environment and produce a good result. When I was the Minister of Environment in Quebec, I was able to bring in overarching sustainable development legislation that went so far as to change the Charter of Rights in the province of Quebec to ensure the right and guarantee that right to live in a clean environment. And that's given rise to a whole series of court cases that have been very, very helpful. So by trying to do the right thing and believing strongly in what you do, that allows you to move on. This June will mark my 40th year in government. I began in 1978. And frankly, what worries me right now are some of the big issues that you see on the front pages. I've never been worried since I was a kid, since the Cuban Missile Crisis, about nuclear war. I'm worried about nuclear war right now. I think that Mr. Trump's saber rattling and the insane behavior by the North Korean government is cause for concern for all of us. That would be cataclysmic, and cooler heads, one hopes, will prevail, as they have in the past. I also think that the world is facing a huge challenge with regard to climate change. And again, I think that people who follow politics remember that Mr. Trudeau got elected when he promised that a project like the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline would never go through unless we had a clear, thorough, complete, credible environmental assessment system, when we got rid of Stephen Harper's system. Unfortunately, that's another broken promise from Justin Trudeau, because now he's trying to shove the Kinder Morgan pipeline down people's throats, and it's never been studied by anything other than Stephen Harper's failed process that Mr. Trudeau used to laugh at. So that's a really huge problem, because that's a question of cynicism. It's a question of whether or not people who get elected deserve to be believed. And it's certainly a question of whether or not they deserve to be reelected.
Since you mentioned about the pipeline, the political tension over the pipeline between BC and Alberta has been going on for a few months now. And both Rachel Notley and John Horgan are from the NDP. How will this change the political dynamics of the NDP party, and how do you see this conflict playing out?
I think we have to respect the voters, first and foremost. Mr. Horgan got a clear mandate to make sure that Kinder Morgan does not go through until it can be studied thoroughly and in a credible manner. And Mr. Trudeau has failed on that. So the fault here is clearly on Mr. Trudeau's shoulders. Rachel Notley, as Premier of Alberta, of course, is doing what you would expect her to do. She's fighting hard to make sure that the raw natural resources of Alberta can be sent to the Orient through ports in Western Canada. We all know what those challenges represent constitutionally, what they represent environmentally, and what they mean economically. But in both cases, it's not surprising that they're taking the stance that they're taking. But what's still missing is Mr. Trudeau respecting his promise to put in a new system that people could have confidence in. And I couldn't agree more with Premier Horgan when he says that these projects can't go ahead until Mr. Trudeau respects his promise to put in place an assessment process that is actually credible and thorough and that the public can have confidence in.
So given the state of contemporary Canadian politics, what kind of advice would you give young people like me and Luthi that want to become involved in the public service and policymaking in Canada?
Well, I think the most important thing to do is to get involved. Now, that can mean simply getting involved in a local environmental group. It can mean helping in a soup kitchen. It can mean going after something that's important in terms of your own values. But be involved in society. And if that gives you the taste to get involved politically, tremendous. And you mentioned the public service. Mm. You know, my whole family has been involved in public service. My mom was a teacher. My wife is a psychologist who works in the healthcare system. Our older son is a police officer in the Quebec Provincial Police. Our younger son is a college professor. Mm-hmm. And I've spent most of my career, although I've done many years in private practice as well, almost my whole career in government, as I mentioned earlier. So I think that if you look at our society and you say, look, I think with my values and my experience and my determination, I can contribute positively. Geez, by all means, consider a career that touches the public, but you don't have to necessarily make it your job. You can make it your part of your time, volunteering, which is another great Canadian value, by the way, volunteerism. And I think it's one that's often underestimated in terms of the results that it can produce.
Some excellent advice. And we have one last question for you, actually. So our program on PRT Weekly, we like to ask our guests if they have any recommendations for a great book to read, if they're interested in learning more about the conversation we've had today. Now, of course, those interested in your career should go and pick up your memoir, Strength of Conviction. But what other book or books would you point out to our listeners if they wanted to become better informed on Canadian politics or what it means to live a life in the public service?
Well, I'm going to give you a reference to a French book written by a fellow who was my director when I was at the Justice Department, and he was actually the person who guided me as I was becoming a member of the bar. His name is Gilles Letourneau, and he's a great lawyer, and he was a tremendous judge at the federal court. He's just retired a couple of years ago. He penned a great book called Combattre l'injustice et réformer, Fighting Injustice and Reforming. And it talks about a lot of the efforts that he's been involved in over the years. And I think that's really something that everybody should be interested in. Now, I have a very large library of books on the environment. But if I were to try to convince people to read one book on the environment, I try to get them to read a book that's been around for quite a while, but that I think laid down the foundation for the modern environmental movement. And that book is called Silent Spring, written by a wonderful woman named Rachel Carson. And I think it can fairly be said that that book really did constitute the beginning of a structured reflection and thought of what action was required to save the physical world around us. And if you haven't had a chance to read it, I think that that's still great reading today.
Thank you for those wonderful recommendations, and a huge thank you from me and Lutfi and the PRT Weekly team and listeners for joining us today on the program and for sharing your insights on current events and what it means to be living a life in the Canadian public service.
Thank you, Mr. Mulcair.
Thanks, Lutfi. Thanks, Nick. All the best. Take care. Bye-bye.
If you'd like to check out more content, other interviews, and PRT Weekly panel discussions, you can find us on pubpoli.com. That's pubpoli.com. You can also find us on Facebook and subscribe to us on iTunes under PRT Weekly. Take care.